you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Dr. Jones is a historian, prolific author, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Among his many books are The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury, and his soon-to-be-published History of Logos and the Logos of History. Did I have that title right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, History of Logos and the Logos of History, soon to be released, soon. So, Dr. Jones, how are you doing?
Just great.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, Tim. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And, well, listen, the reason I invited you back on the show is I wanted to talk about this book of yours that you wrote about a quarter of a century ago, Dionysus Rising, The Birth of Cultural Revolution Out of the Spirit of Music. Now, yes. I'd like to talk to you about this book, about the book itself, what it covers, and also what you've learned since then about music and the weaponization of music. Now, I heard you talk about this book in a couple of public lectures you gave fairly recently, and you were saying how you were driven to write or persuaded to write this book after you had written Degenerate Moderns, another book that I recommend. I read a long time ago. Yes. And I guess it was the daughter-in-law of Malcolm Muggeridge who said, write a book about music. And you were thinking, yeah, I'll write a book about music. And you said, well, modern music starts with Schoenberg. But then he did a little research and he came up with a different conclusion. And you start off with this character, Richard Wagner. So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, that's right. The late Anne Roche Muggeridge read Degenerate Moderns and liked it. And she said, yeah, do modern music. So I thought it was going to be an article, you know, which is basically what Degenerate Moderns was. It was a series of articles, kind of like a brief biographical sketch. But it turned out to be more complicated than I expected, because when I went to Schoenberg, it turns out that his most famous piece, namely Verklärte Nacht, was a smeared version of Tristan und Isolde. That was the description of his brother-in-law, Zemlinsky. That's how he described it. And lo and behold, yeah, that's exactly what it was. And so I had to go to Wagner, and Wagner as the revolutionary. He was a revolutionary in the Revolution of 1848. He was had a price on his head. He was wanted by the government of Prussia or Saxony or one of those places and had to escape to Switzerland. And he basically spent his time in Switzerland thinking over the revolution, you know. And I think in many ways he spent the rest of his life thinking about the revolution and why it failed. So it took two directions, and this is not part of Dionysus Rising. I didn't realize that it was two directions until later when I was doing the book on capitalism that you mentioned, Baron Metal. But the first direction was basically transmuting the political revolution into a sexual revolution. And that's what Tristan and Isolde did. He basically dramatized his own sexual problems. He was a resolute heterosexual. So let's get that out in the open right now. He was attracted to other men's wives. And he struggled. He struggled with it. And the struggle is in Tannhäuser. If you're familiar with that opera, there is a scene in the middle of it where he gets every red-blooded German's wish, called the Venusberg, which is Venus's mountain, or Mons Veneris, but that means something else. But where he goes there and he can just have, it's like the paradise of sexual delight. You know, you get everything you want and screw as many women as you want. But that's only part of it. There are also the pilgrims in Tannhäuser, and the pilgrims were going to Rome. And the Pilgrim Chorus is, in my humble opinion, one of the great pieces of music ever written. And Wagner's written a number of them. It's a piece that I remember hearing it for the first time and just being stunned at how powerful that piece of music was. And it's a very strong piece. And so what you have here is basically a dichotomy here between the music inside the Venusberg and the music outside the Venusberg. The Pilgrim's Chorus is ba 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 ba. Very strong piece of music, a powerful piece of music. And don't ask me to hum the part in the Venusberg because I can't, because it's a completely different idea of music. So you have the diatonic scale, which I just hummed. Which has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and is thereby fulfills Aristotle's understanding of what drama should be. Okay? And Aristotle's Poetics is probably the best piece written on music in the classical world. And it took me a long time to figure it out because I thought it was about drama. But it's much more insightful about music than it is about drama. But so that's, that fulfills Aristotle's condition for drama, and the diatonic scale is dramatic. As I said, it has a beginning and a middle and the end. Well, you can't say that about the scale that he used for the Venusberg. That is, it was used by the Italians to give color to a line. Okay, so it's called the chromatic scale. And the chromatic scale is not dramatic. It's too predictable to be dramatic. It's just half steps. And it just goes on and on and on. And that's the vehicle that Wagner chose for sexual liberation. And that's the vehicle. He tried it out in the later version of the Tannhäuser. That's the chromatic scale, the chromatic music that's get played in the Venusberg. If, as a musical joke, I think, Gustav Holst used Tristan's chromatic scale when he did the planets. And guess which planet it was? It was Venus. Mm-hmm. Okay? Which I think was his idea of a musical joke, not strong like Jupiter, for example, or Mars. Mars is a very strong martial type of planet. But so that's the conflict. And Wagner in Tannhäuser kind of puts up a fight and he's torn. And then with Tristan and Isolde, he completely capitulates to sexual liberation and hands himself over to the Venusberg. And it's like one long hour after hour meditation on adultery. So it's like, you know, intercourse going on forever and ever. Or it's like what you see here is you're kind of, as I said, the diatonic scale is a beginning and middle and end. Here you kind of set off from the shore of melody and you never return. And of course, that is the beginning of Schoenberg's notion of atonality, which he got from Wagner. And the intermediary step was his, as I said, Verklärte Nacht. So that's kind of the general gist of the whole thing.
Hmm. So you have Wagner, who experiences the failed revolution of 1848 in Dresden with Buchanan, and he escapes. You alluded to that. And
yes.
It's his realization that a political revolution cannot be successful, but a cultural revolution using the vehicle of the arts is the way to go, is how you overturn society and bring about the revolution.
Yes, yes. Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. And one of his first converts was Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was a young man who got the piano score of Tristan and Isolde and started playing it, and it completely deranged this young man. And the result was that he went out and deliberately infected himself with syphilis. Now, this is a contested claim, I know, but I think it's true. And I think what you're seeing at the end of Nietzsche's life is basically tertiary syphilis, where syphilis goes to the brain. And one of the manifestations of tertiary syphilis when it goes to the brain is delusions of grandeur. And anyone who has read Nietzsche's last works, like Why I Write Such Wonderful Books and stuff like that, I think can see this type of delusions of grandeur. I think, to give another aside, I think it's in... secondly, Dracula is about syphilis. And I think you see these delusions of grandeur in the character of Bram Stoker's last book, The Lair of the White Worm. But that's getting a little bit beside the point. But Nietzsche absolutely idolized Wagner and basically took his idea of sexual liberation that he found in Tristan and Isolde and tried to turn it into a program, a cultural program of rebellion against God. The first book he wrote was the where I got my title was The Birth of Tragedy, which was about Greek philosophy and about Dionysus, the cult of Dionysus, and in particular Euripides' play The Bacchae, which is one of the greatest plays of all human history, as far as I'm concerned, and still relevant today, especially relevant today. So to take that trajectory one step further, we have Thomas Mann, who said he went to virtually every Wagnerian opera he could attend, and he was part of the cult of Richard Wagner in Germany at the end of the 19th century, which was leading Germany down the path of paganism, and Hitler would be the culmination of that trajectory. And Thomas Mann's Death in Venice is sort of taking both Wagner and Nietzsche to the next step. Let's take it to the next level. Let's have Gustav Aschenbach go to Venice. He's on vacation and he's a homosexual and he falls in love with a Polish teenager and the plague breaks out and is it worth dying for? Is sex worth dying for? And of course, we know that in the 1970s, Michel Foucault, the successor of Nietzsche, the French successor with Nietzsche, would give a resounding yes to that question. Yes, sex is worth dying for. And Foucault died doing what he loved, namely engaging in sadomasochistic sex in the bathhouses of San Francisco. He was hired by Berkeley at that time. So you have kind of the trajectory there that Wagner got started when he did Tristan and Isolde.
I found it was interesting that the description of the Vanishberg being a dark cavern or cave, not lit or anything, would bear a similarity to, you know, the gay bathhouses that were so notorious.
Yes, that's exactly what it was. But he was resolutely homosexual. Mm-hmm. Also, what you would say here is this theme is also in Tristan and Isolde, where the famous aria in Tristan und Isolde is Zinkernieder, Nacht der Liebe.
Okay, we're back in. Got cut off. I'm sorry. Where were we?
I was talking about you mentioned darkness and the bathhouse aspect of the Vanishberg, and I think that's true. And I was talking about how Tristan, the famous aria in Tristan, is O Zinkernieder, Nacht der Liebe, descend, O night of love. And I also said that it was the end of the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment aria, the Enlightenment opera is the magic flute, Zauberflöte, and it's a Masonic opera, and the villain is the Queen of the Night, which is the Catholic Church, and the hero of that opera is Zoroastro, who is the head of the Masonic Lodge, and his famous aria is Die strahlende Sonne vertreiben die Nacht, which means the rays of the sun drive away the night. So that's the end of that particular period, and now we're entering into a new era of sexual liberation where people deliberately seek out the darkness of lust. Thomas Mann has a brilliant passage in Death in Venice about the Dionysian orgy or the Dionysian festival. It is one of the greatest passages in German literature. I wish I had it in front of me. I would read it to you in German, but your listeners probably wouldn't understand it anyway. But take my word for it. It's one of the greatest passages in German literature.
Now, there's the issue here, the question of the function of melody in music, harmony, and how harmony in music is sort of like harmony in the political order, and how when you disrupt harmony in music, you unleash these revolutionary forces. And music is the same thing. And could you go into that?
Yeah, Plato was very explicit about certain modes not being permitted in the ideal state because they would arouse the passions. This tradition of world harmony was carried all the way to Shakespeare. Shakespeare could drill down to bedrock of the Western culture, and it comes out in Merchant of Venice, where the daughter of Shylock runs off with a Christian, and he takes her outside, and now he's got to teach her what it means to be a Christian. So he takes her outside, the stars are shining, he says, look up at that sky, there's an order to that sky, and it's just like music. And what we see here is that's what harmony is. There's a celestial harmony there. And that's what my book is about. It's about Logos. In the 8th century BC, people all across the world realized that there was an order to the universe, and then they tried to figure out what the implications of that were. This is what Lorenzo is saying to Jessica in Merchant of Venice. And the reason he's telling that to her is because she's a Jew. And Jews don't have logos. This is the gist of my book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. But it's also the gist of Shakespeare's play, Merchant of Venice. He has no harmony. There is no music in Shylock. There's no logos. There's no understanding of the logos of the universe. All he can think about are his ducats. And whether there's a scene, when they played it at Notre Dame, it was funny the way Shylock played it. But he's going on, when his daughter runs off, she takes some of his money. And he's going, my daughter, my ducats, my daughter, my ducats. He can't figure out which he's missing more. You know, is he missing the ducats more than the daughter? He can't really make up his mind because that's all he's interested in. And that's, Jews are involved in usury, and that's what the whole play is about. It's about the Jewish conflict, the Jewish-Christian conflict over the logos, over the order of society, and over usury. And so what Shylock says, his famous line is, "I crave the law." Well, that's typical of the Jew who wants this obsolete Mosaic law because he can't, he's blind to the new dispensation, which is Jesus Christ. And Christ brings mercy. And that's Portia's famous speech in The Merchant of Venice about the quality of mercy. And the whole play is about, well, be careful what you ask for because you may get it. And so he demands a pound of flesh, and he turns out he can't draw any blood. And so the whole, it's just a great play, absolutely great play, because it deals with the reality of the situation in a very intense way. So it's a great play, and it also has direct relevance to Arnold Schoenberg. Okay, to come to the third part of Dionysus Rising. Schoenberg, as his name indicates, was a Jew. But he was a Jew, an assimilated Jew, living in Vienna at the turn of the century, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And that meant he was involved with Wagner. Wagner just dominated that zeitgeist. And the what dominated it was this desire for some type of sexual liberation. So Schoenberg's married, and it turns out he's on the receiving end of sexual liberation. His wife has an affair with some artist whose name is in the book, and I forget at this point. The artist committed suicide. Schoenberg found out about it, and Schoenberg is now full of rage at what? Well, he had converted to Christianity. He was a Lutheran, and now he feels betrayed by this culture, which I don't see in any way, shape, or form as Christian. I mean, obviously, yes, Vienna was a Christian Catholic place, but the Wagnerian element was certainly not Christian. It was anti-Christian, if anything. But for some reason, Schoenberg now wants revenge on Christianity. So he renounces his baptism, and he takes musical revenge on the Christian West by abandoning tonality, by abandoning the diatonic scale, by abandoning the logos of music. In other words, the thing that he could perceive because he became a Christian, the thing which Shylock could not perceive, the music of the spheres, the music and the logos of the universe, Schoenberg could apprehend it to some extent by becoming a Christian, and now he renounces it, and now his whole life is basically going to be revenge because his wife cheated on him.
In irony, he was an advocate of free love, right?
Theoretically. Until his wife gets him, beats him to the punch, and then he's no longer an advocate of free love. He's an advocate of punishment and revenge. And so musical revenge becomes the law. Well, what's the law? What does he mean by the law? Well, it turns out it's the 12-tone system. A 12-tone, the intermediary stage was atonal music, which, like Wagner's chromatic scale, just wanders off, never gets back to the final, the thing you started with, which is something Beethoven would never do. You know, I mean, Beethoven, you could consider the Fifth Symphony, revolutionary music. I mean, he was inspired by Napoleon spreading the French Revolution throughout Europe. But he always got back to the key that you started in. You know what I mean?
Like the French Revolution.
You always got back, yeah. And you never really went the whole way.
Yeah.
And what you see with Wagner is he did. He shed off from the shore, and he never came back again. And Schoenberg took that, and he created atonality.
I'm sorry. And Wagner's music is unrestrained passion, emotion, right?
Yes.
I have that right? And Schoenberg would be described as sort of a reaction to that.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the first reaction is atonality, but it didn't go anywhere. So he's got to come up with a better way to punish us all, and it's 12-tone music. Now, in the book, in Dionysus Rising, I think I show with some conviction that Schoenberg didn't even Didn't even invent it. He stole it from a Catholic. It's the if you want to know the if you want to delve into this, it's called the Wiener Prioritätsstreit. It's the Viennese priority conflict about who created 12-tone music. Was it Schoenberg or was it Joseph Matthias Hauer? Hauer. And I think it was Hauer. I don't think there's any question about it. There was a novel written about him, and Hauer was a guy who was absolutely scandalized by the sensuality of Wagnerian music. So he decided to come up with the opposite of Wagnerian music. So what are the options here? Okay, you have harmony, which is like sex in a sense, because you have two notes joining and becoming one. Okay, so that would be like marriage. I shouldn't have said sex. I should have said marriage. Okay, conjugal union, it's harmony. The conjugal union is a symbol of the harmony of the universe. Mm-hmm. Okay, now with Wagner, they never got over it. They just were screwing forever, which is not part of, it's not humanly possible. It's like a fantasy. With Schoenberg and 12-tone music, you have a complete prohibition of any type of union. These notes never come together, and that, I think, was Joseph Matthias Hauer's contribution, because he just felt upset. He had a kind of weird, what's the word I'm trying to look at? Squeamishness when it came to bodily functions?
Neurosis, maybe, yeah.
I don't know. He's just very squeamish when it came to bodily functions, and he was appalled by human sexuality. And so what you have are notes that never don't come together at all. There is no harmony possible. It's just one note after another till you go through the entire scale, and then you start all over again. So it is a formula. It is a mechanical formula. It's not music. I'm sorry. It's not music. It's a musical ideology which Schoenberg used to punish us all because his wife cheated on him. Us all, meaning the goyim in the West.
And in the book, you sort of draw an analogy between Schoenberg's music and sort of this, it's referred to as what music in the straitjacket, as sort of a reaction, the same way that maybe Hitler's Germany was a reaction to Weimar's excesses.
Right,
or Stalin's regime, the excess of the Lenin era.
It's like the tyrant has now returned to restore order. It's just what Plato said about the states. You know, how democracy leads to, how plutocracy leads to democracy, and democracy leads to anarchy, and anarchy leads to tyranny. Democracy is his word for anarchy. The same thing happened here musically. So you had the freedom run riot in Tristan and Isolde, and now you have the tyrannical reaction of the 12-tone scale, which is, it's not a natural order. If you were restoring the natural order, that would be great, but that's not what you're doing. The diatonic scale is in many ways the natural order. What you're doing is imposing an artificial order in order to bring about order, because everything has gotten out of control. And that's the term that they, I forget the German's name who did this, but a brilliant book called Musik in der Zwangsjacke, or Music in the Straitjacket, which talks about, among other things, how professional musicians who are forced to play 12-tone music have a higher incidence of illness than musicians who don't play 12-tone music.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what the Pythagoreans sort of made that observation way back about health and harmony in music.
That's right. And I think that there is an element of truth to that. There is, we are, the body, health is another word for harmony. It's the peaceful resolution and interaction of all of these different parts. That's what a symphony is. That's what society is supposed to be. We have all these rich musical metaphors that describe getting along with each other in this world. Harmony is the best example.
And, now, you have Schoenberg, who claimed takes credit for his music, but he's promoted by people like Theodor Adorno, who
yes. So what happens is Hitler loses the war, And now everything that Hitler condemned is now good. So it was Entartete Kunst, all of this Jewish cultural Bolshevism during the Weimar Republic, now comes back with a vengeance, a Jewish vengeance, and takes over Germany. And so the result is we have the performance of Moses and Aaron in Berlin in 1954, and anyone who can't listen to this insufferable piece of musical aggression is called an anti-Semite.
And this destroys the German, I guess, capacity for classical music, and they resort to popular music.
That's going a little far, because I don't think that can be destroyed. I think it's still there. And I can get to the personal angle here. I'm in Germany in 1970. I'm a rock star because I'm an American. We have this band, and we have all these people coming to our band. And there's one guy in the band who has real talent, and that is not me. That's not me. That's my friend Heiner Frost, who went on to study classical music at the Robert Schumann Institute in Düsseldorf. And so, you know, what are you listening to? Well, it turns out he's studying 12-tone music. And I said to him, I said, Heiner, this isn't music. This is psychological warfare. And he kind of laughs at me like the loony American conspiracy nut, until it turns out, yeah, I'm right. I am right. Musical summer schools in Donaueschingen were all funded by the CIA.
This is the Cultural Cold War, yeah.
Yeah, this is the Cultural Cold War. The Congress of Cultural Freedom was one manifestation. All those phony subsidized journals was another. Jackson Pollock, abstract expressionist exhibitions. We all know they were subsidized by the CIA. And now it turns out that 12-tone music was subsidized by the CIA as well. Südwest Rundfunk and Donaueschingen were two of the leading things. And here's my friend Heiner, who has real musical ability, just doing this god-awful stuff. Now, I'd like to say he's a recovering 12-tone composer because he discovered Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, the fact that Heiner studied music and had to discover Bach on his own is something that speaks volumes about the attempt of the United States to engage in the social engineering of German culture. I was in Weimar. I believe it was 1996, and they're giving a tour of Weimar, which is the Kulturstadt Weimar, you know, on the list of the UN list of great cities in the world. And we're going around. It looks pretty nice to me. There's a statue of Goethe and Schiller there in the Marktplatz. And then suddenly there's a hole in the ground. Oh, what's the hole in the ground? Well, it turns out it's Bach's house. Well, wait a minute. Why is there a hole in the ground? Well, because the Allies bombed it. So first of all, they didn't destroy anything in Weimar other than Bach's house. And 20, what is it now? We're talking about 40 to 90, almost 50 years after the war, it still hasn't been built up again. So I think this is symptomatic of the American aggression against German culture that took place after World War II. And my friend Heiner was a victim of it until he had to discover Bach on his own.
Yes, well, it had to destroy Dresden, too, I guess. It was just too beautiful of a city.
It was. So I think we're reaching, I mean, geopolitically, I think we're reaching the end of that era. And the man who's going to bring about the total liberation of Germany, I think, is none other than Donald Trump. Who has annoyed everybody in the entire world. I think Donald Trump, to get off topic here for a minute, is an example of what Hegel calls die List der Vernunft, the cunning of reason. God is using, Vernunft is Hegel's word for God, Logos, God. And God is using Trump to bring about an end to the American empire, a peaceful end. Let's all pray for a peaceful end. I think the whole world is groaning and wants an end to it, and a lot of Americans as well.
But I do find it interesting that at this critical period, the 1950s, of course, Germany is conquered, divided, and controlled, you know, at this point. But Theodor Adorno, this, you know, from the Frankfurt School, would so be so involved in the promotion of of Schoenberg's music, and I guess you write, a dissonance to Theodore Adorno, dissonance was an antidote to the order of nature, was the diatonic scale, which was the diatonic scale. Like Nietzsche, Adorno saw dissonance as a blow against the established order. No harmony to suppress the human will. So this is sort of music's internal logic. Its rules restrain human will. We have to succumb to the musical's laws. It's the same way we have to succumb to the natural law to be healthy and happy. But this is by destroying the diatonic scale and imposing human will on music. It was sort of a representation of sort of this Nietzschean outlook on worldview. Correct.
Right. That the culmination of that was Foucault, and yeah. Now all of this attack on identity through gender. Basically, there's no such thing as gender. It's all a social construct. Blah blah blah. But you're right. Schoenberg eventually escaped during World War II. He ended up in Hollywood, and there he met George Gershwin. Schoenberg was an avid tennis player. He apparently played tennis with George Gershwin, and George Gershwin knew about the famous Schoenberg, and so he went up to him and he asked him if he would teach him harmony. One of Schoenberg's books was Harmonielehre. So the story is, at this point, Schoenberg then turns to Gershwin and says, "How much money do you make a year?" And then Gershwin tells him, and then Schoenberg says, "Well, maybe I should take lessons from you." So Schoenberg, needless to say, was not a hit in Hollywood. His stuff was just too ideological, too theoretical, but he became a hit, as you indicated, with the Frankfurt School. Mm-hmm. And Theodor Wiesengrund Adorno, who I think this is what people say, he's the model for the devil in Thomas Mann's novel Dr. Faustus, which he wrote in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And Europe was going up in flames. So we have here a conflation of a whole bunch of different stories. Also in Luchino Visconti's filming of Death in Venice, you have a conflation of these stories too. It's like a conflation of Death in Venice and Dr. Faustus, where Dr. Faustus basically, it's Adrian Leverkühn in Dr. Faustus, and he is the Nietzsche character, but he's like a combination of Nietzsche and Schoenberg. And he basically sells his soul to the devil with this demonic pact by contracting syphilis, so that when you get tertiary syphilis, I said there's these delusions of grandeur. It's like the light bulb that gets real bright right before it burns out. And so Adrian Leverkühn was hoping that that would happen with syphilis, and he'd write the greatest piece of music ever written. Well, I would suggest another way of trying to write music. No, yeah. I don't recommend this as a way of composing music.
For inspiration, no. In the book, you also talk about, I think it is the chapter on Schoenberg, but in 1941, just after Pearl Harbor, a Japanese submarine lobbed a few shells and hit a refinery or nearby and didn't do any harm anybody, didn't do much damage, but it caused sort of hysteria of an imminent Japanese invasion. But nevertheless, you write in the book how, well, this wasn't the beginning of a Japanese invasion. What it was the beginning of a German invasion. And not the Germans we're talking about.
Yeah, the Germans took over Hollywood. Well, took over is kind of an exaggeration, but there were a lot of German expatriates in Hollywood at that time.
This was the Frankfurt School coming. Some went to New York and Columbia.
Yeah, they were involved in a lot. The AJC, basically, the American Jewish Committee, brought them over and basically put them to work to attack the Catholics. The book that they brought out was called The Authoritarian Personality.
Yeah.
And that became a way of that became the justification for breaking up ethnic neighborhoods because of these narrow-minded Catholics that the Jews didn't like. And I cover that in my book, The Slaughter of Cities.
Yes, extensively. We've done interviews on that and the sort of the breakup of the ethnic neighborhood, the creation of suburbia, the destruction of Catholic urban neighborhoods, and these things. ethnic warfare that was going on, that was declared by the authoritarian personality. And even in this book, I see you kind of allude to it, or use the beginnings of your understanding of it, perhaps, is how it plays into sort of the how Schoenberg's music led to the rise of jazz and ultimately rock and roll, and how
there's a great passage that I quote in there. George Antheil, whose great piece was Johnny Spielt Auf, his opera. He said, if we had to listen to one more piece by Schoenberg, we all would have committed suicide. So it was with great relief that we greeted the first Negro jazz band when it arrived in Paris in 1919. And at that point, what you're seeing is the shift. So Dionysian music Wagner had his own version of Dionysian music, and that was Tristan und Isolde, and it had a powerful effect on Germany, but it just ran into the sand with Schoenberg. Nobody could carry that forward, and it became impossible to listen to, and at that point Dionysian music shifted and it became Negro jazz as interpreted by the Jews, who basically ran the Harlem Renaissance. All happened around the same time. Mm-hmm. Henry Ford has a famous line in The International Jew. He says jazz was a creation of a Jew by the name of Frisco. I don't know where he got that, but that's what he said. But I think jazz was certainly a Jewish creation. And you had this kind of Jewish black collaboration as part of this cultural version of the Black Jewish Alliance that goes all the way up to the creation of rap music with Def Jam Records, which was also Jewish and black. So jazz was subversive. It was more compelling, I think, than anything Schoenberg ever wrote. And it got more and more compelling and more erotic as time went on, to the point of wretched excess, which is, I don't know, where would wretched excess come in? Led Zeppelin's tour of America in 1975, something like that, you know?
So the Dionysian rock star being the paradigm for...
Right, but let's say the 1969, the year I got married, was the year of Woodstock and also the year of Altamont. And I think this was the culmination of the Dionysian Festival. These were real Dionysian festivals. And, you know, lots of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And in true to the nature of the Dionysian Festival, as described by Euripides in the Bacchae, someone died. And so you can watch the documentary film Gimme Shelter by the Maisley Brothers. And in that, you can see during the Rolling Stone concert in Altamont, black guy being stabbed to death by the Hell's Angels, who were hired as security guards.
Mm-hmm. And the idea was that at this point, classical music had become so, well, unlistenable because of Schoenberg, that it created immediately a vacuum was filled by rock music. Of course, this is the post-war.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Nobody could. I mean, can you listen to? I forgot what's the guy's name? The guy who just sat there and did nothing for 7 minutes.
A Cage.
John Cage. Yeah. Can anyone seriously take this stuff seriously? I mean, it became a joke, and so Aquinas says at one point that if you need beauty in your life, and if you don't have beauty in higher things, you're going to seek beauty in lower things. And one of the most beautiful things is the female body, and so it becomes the fixation of people that don't have beauty in their culture. And so you have the sexualization of the culture. And music led the way as part of the sexualization of our culture. It's absolutely no question. I was there. I watched it happen. I had a front row seat. I was a rock star myself in Germany. So I sort of watched it as it happened. I was saved by the grace of God from what could have happened to me, but I could see it happening in other people.
Yeah, this was, I mean, you mentioned it in the book about this intersection of events, which turns out wasn't spontaneous or accidental or coincidental, is the movement of blacks from the South into the North into the urban areas. And this is sort of where some of your other research regarding architecture, like Bauhaus and Gropius, the construction of these large tenement houses coupled with the urban environment and also the civil rights movement and the sort of Norman Mailer, the white Negro, sort of this raising the black as a sexual revolutionary, the paradigm of sexual freedom, and how the stereotype of black sexual behavior was promoted as good and then spread into the white culture via music, correct?
Yeah. And what I didn't realize in Dionysus Rising, because I hadn't put two and two together, was the role that the Jews played in this thing. They were the crucial cultural brokers. And so you had people like the Chess Brothers in Chicago with Chess Records, basically bilking people, stealing money from people like Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry.
Yeah, and their sexual freedom was the source of their slavery, because they were constantly being bailed out to pay for abortions, to get girls out of trouble, you know, these things. They're like giving spending money. At the same time, they're being their royalties were being stolen.
So that was the crucial role that they played. I didn't see it at the time. I didn't see it until I wrote The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, and suddenly it all became clear to me, the Black Jewish Alliance and basically the Jews trying to turn the Negro in America into the avant-garde of his revolution, either literally, like at the time of the Scottsboro Boys, to have a slave revolt down in the South, or in a cultural revolution by making the Negro, like as Norman Mailer put it, he was a Jew. He claimed he was a white Negro. So getting white people to accept the sexual mores of the Negro as a form of liberation. Jack Kerouac, a white boy, actually he's not white, he's Catholic, he's a French Canadian, but he succumbed to it, and he wrote that novel On the Road about then. He was a man who was corrupted by music. When he went to Columbia University, and he used to go to these clubs in Harlem, and it just corrupted him, you know. And I don't think he ever recovered, really.
And the sad irony of that is the so-called sexual freedom enjoyed by so many in the black community is the source of so much of their misery, high crime, family dissolution. And as it spreads and becomes more common in the white society becomes even more vulnerable. It succumbs to what you call sort of a cultural AIDS.
So right around the time I wrote, right around the time of the publication of Dionysus Rising, I gave a talk at Harvard called Spade Kicks, The Negro as a Paradigm of Sexual Liberation. And Spade Kicks is a quote taken from Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road. Mm-hmm. And I put a picture of some high yaller at Small's Palette Paradise doing a striptease, and it was like the end of the world as we know it at Harvard University. It caused so much controversy. My son graduated that year, and we watched got the Harvard Crimson, and four of the top 20 events of that year at Harvard were my talk and the fallout from my talk. So it was a huge. In the middle of the talk, after the question period, someone said to me, well, everything you're saying is in the library here at Harvard. And I said, yeah, so why are you so mad at me? Well, it's because I put it together in a way that was not politically correct. You weren't allowed to do it. You know, it's like when you say the Jews are behind gay marriage, they call you an anti-Semite, but when Amy Dean says it, it's okay because you have a smile on your face or something like that, you know? So it was huge. It was huge because no one wanted to touch that issue. No one wanted to talk about the Black Jewish Alliance. No one wanted to talk about the weaponization of the Negro by the Jew. It just was taboo. It's probably still taboo.
You also write about in the Jewish revolutionary spirit about what happened down south with the Leo Frank trial and the exploitation of problems down there, and this is Jewish revolutionary spirit, not Dionysus Rising, but the Jewish takeover of folk music as an attempt to radicalize the South, mobilize the South and these things.
Right.
And this was, as you write, it's not so much, it's communism is an expression of Jewish radicalism. Isn't communism being used by the Jews, or it is in a way, but you're saying what this really bespeaks is this penchant for subversion and revolutionary activity.
Yeah.
Both culture and political, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a whole discussion in the Jewish revolutionary spirit about, well, what is revolutionary music?
Mm-hmm.
So Comrade Jerome had, you know, his idea of revolutionary music was something in D minor, you know, because he was a Russian. And so they go to the Jews who were organizing the labor movement, go down to Appalachia, and they suddenly start playing, you know, Wildwood Flower or something like that. Well, it's not revolutionary. That's not what that is. That's Appalachian music. It's Scotch-Irish traditional music that is, you know, but that's what they had, and they tried to turn it into something revolutionary. And they did. I mean, they succeeded. They succeeded. Because the folk music movement became the revolutionary movement. And so all you have to do is read Ron Radish's memoir, Commies, and you realize that Pete Seeger had a big role to play teaching these Jews at their summer camps in the Catskills how to play the five-string banjo and how that became some type of vehicle for revolution because the Jews were involved in it. That's what they made it. That's what they do.
And this is where you get people like, well, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and then, of course, Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah, Bob Dylan's the most famous of all of these people. And in many ways, he blew the whole thing up by electrifying the instruments, and it got out of control. But, I mean, that's the trajectory that we're talking about.
Yeah. Now, you also, in the tail end of Dionysus Rising, you talk about, of course, the Sympathy for the Devil, the piece on the Rolling Stones, but the English rock music scene and these Dionysian rock festivals, and the role of a character like Aleister Crowley, who you say was the main... Aleister Crowley became the main vehicle for sort of taking the Nietzschean occult readings and making it popular culture, spreading it through the general society. These things.
Yeah, he's on the cover of the Sgt. Pepper's Lone Hearts Club Band album. And apparently Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin used to collect his artifacts of his, and I think bought his house or something like that. It's an endgame scenario. And then it became popularized by, isn't this... I lost all interest in this kind of music at a certain point, so I'm kind of... And it's not really in the book, but isn't Ozzy Osbourne part of this whole devil type of stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Black Sabbath. And then I think Black he's the one that their album that said that we sold our souls for rock and roll. And
yeah,
of course, that
yeah.
goes back to the Robert Johnson era. That's an old thing. He had a song for Crowley in these. Yeah.
So at that point, I lost interest. Sorry. I just checked out. And in many ways, so I mean, to get personal here again, I came back from Germany, and I basically stopped playing the guitar for 20 years and listened to classical music for 20 years. And basically Dionysus Rising is the fruit of listening to classical music for 20 years. And then at a certain point, I got tired of listening to classical music. And I started playing ethnic music, and that was the revival of Irish music in South Bend, Indiana. And so I played Irish music for 16 years or so at a pub every night. And now I feel I can't do that anymore. I don't know what happened, but I just think that these things go in phases, and I'm just entering another phase.
Mm-hmm. Well, the takeaway from this, from your book, and you have it near the end, is that the sexual revolution ends in death. It's a death cult.
Yes.
And you write here, if I may quote, that some culture has found a home with us through the agency of rock music and the Nietzschean philosophy. The major phenomena of our age, AIDS, drug abuse, terrorism, skepticism, and the ruin of the universities, the destruction of high culture, especially music, the breakdown of the family, especially in the inner city. These are all epiphenomena of the Dionysian ecstasy, which is to say the desire for sexual liberation from the constraints of the moral law that has been so avidly sought for more than 100 years now. We as a culture desire sexual liberation, yet we're unwilling to admit the price we have to pay for to get it. The Satanists are only more consistent than the rest of us in this. They know that there can be no sexual liberation, no culture of Dionysian excess without human sacrifice. We are loath to face this fact. MTV can regularly urge parricide, yet there is always shock and consternation when someone gets hurt. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and it is. Ultimately, it's about human sacrifice. It's a culture of death.
Yeah. So you could talk about abortion, okay? And then I took that theme a step further when I did Monsters from the Id, mm-hmm. which is about horror movies. And that is that horror movies are the sequel to the sexual revolution. And Alien is the sequel to Deep Throat. By 1979, oral sex wasn't funny anymore. And sex could kill you. And one of the great transitional moments was Last House on the Left by Wes Craven, director Wes Craven. And the whole point of that movie is that the daughter goes off to a rock concert. And then it ends up in this, like the rock concert opens up horror. That's Wes Craven's first movie. And he went on to become famous for the parodies of horror movies like the Scream series. He mm-hmm. did which was the end of the whole horror movie movement because it had become parody at that point.
Yeah, the girl takes her clothes off and then she's murdered.
That's right.
Yeah, which is...
That's the story in a nutshell. One of the crucial transitional movies was Last House on the Left, which was about a rock concert. Bloodlust is the name of the rock band. So the dad is saying, well, have a good time at the Bloodlust concert, honey. Sends his daughter off. Bad idea. Don't do it. It's like, don't open that door in the horror movies. No, don't go out into the woods. Don't do that. It's a bad idea. But that was the transition. It was the transition to from rock and roll to horror. And I guess Alice Cooper did it too. Now I'm just thinking off the top of my head now, but I mean there was a transition there as well. Mm-hmm. Alice Cooper was like a horror show, a rock and roll horror show, or the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
That's right. Yeah. Now, when you wrote this book in the early to mid '90s, of course, a lot has been revealed since then about the weaponization of music and how this isn't just sort of the trend that culture is taking. This isn't greedy record companies lowering everything down to lowest common denominator to maximize profits. It's obviously a function of it. But others have done research regarding outfits like the Grateful Dead and their ties to promoting LSD and the CIA. Tavistock, the Grateful Dead's tour manager was Alan Trist, who was the son of one of the founders of Tavistock. Dave McGowan's research regarding Laurel Canyon and the ties between some of the premier rock bands of the 1960s. To intelligence and military, Jim Morrison's father in these things. It seems to be much more contrived or planned. The Beatles and their involvement in Tavistock and how these things, even the Rolling Stones and the London School of Economics, Mick Jagger, I think, came out of there. Sort of the Fabian School and these things. The British invasion, perhaps, was, coming out of Tavistock. Not a shock, really. Given this research, how would you reevaluate what the music industry, what these bands represent, and is this sort of a form of like cybernetics or culture? Is it a more direct or planned out psychological warfare than you may have previously suspected?
Yes, I think you're right, and mm-hmm. I think the key to that, the best example. I was never persuaded by the Beatles-Tavistock connection, to be mm-hmm. honest with you. But I think the best example would be the Grateful Dead and LSD. Mm-hmm. I think that they had a chemist involved with the band, a guy by the name of Owsley, who cooked up this LSD. And the band's concerts became a distribution point for LSD. Now, LSD was a real establishment deep state project. There's mm-hmm. absolutely no question about it. Okay, the CIA got involved in the MK Ultra program, And you had a guy like Timothy Leary, who found out about LSD, and then either one, I think what happened is that he did find, he did believe what he was saying, and then he did, became this guru about drugs, like tune in, turn on, and drop out. And then at that point, he started off in the CIA, he went rogue, and then the CIA reeled him back in again because they realized how useful he could be with the whole LSD project.
Yes.
So at the end of his life, he said, I never stopped working for the CIA. He said that. But the other example, which is even more telling, I think, is the Time Life article on LSD.
Yeah, the May 1957, Gordon Wasson, yeah.
Well, this, I remember reading this as a teenager. Now, it must have been later. No, it must have been later. Did you say 67?
It was the Gordon Wasson article, the Magic Mushroom article, was Gordon Wasson had worked on his publication, and it's been tied back to MKUltra, his MKUltra project. Gordon Wasson was the head of PR for J.P. Morgan Bank, thus linking intelligence to banking to the publishing industry. And of course, you've written a lot on Henry Luce and Time Life Empire, right. Its ties to intelligence.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, like you said, it's, these are concentric circles. They all work together too.
Yeah, and Luce, as I said, Luce, Time Life, and the CIA were basically two parts of the same organization.
Yeah.
And the crucial guy linking him was C.D. Jackson,
mm-hmm.
Who was both an employee of the CIA and Luce's right-hand man. So Time Life was the propaganda ministry for the United States, and they started promoting LSD. I remember reading the article. I remember looking at all these weird dudes from California with their long hair, and I think, what's this all about? But there was a concerted push in, not just in, Cary Grant did in the Saturday Evening Post, of all places, talking about his LSD
yeah.
trips and so on and so forth. So yeah, it was there. I think that to say that I think the best example was Timothy Leary, that the CIA got involved in something that they wanted to use as mind control. Timothy Leary stumbled across it and went rogue, as I said, and then they reeled him back in again. So I think it's not as if some master guy is pulling all the strings, but on the other hand, it didn't just happen either.
No, and also, I mean, we've done talks and I've done interviews regarding the use of publishing and advertising and media and Hollywood in promoting certain cultural trends to achieve a demographic outcome or a political outcome. You did an article about how the CIA working with MGM produced the blaxploitation films, and that's definitely definitely psychological warfare, and that's involving music and
right.
and violence and drugs and sex and these things. So all yeah. these things are being promoted.
It's nice that we can have this discussion because we're bringing in pieces of things that I've written over almost the past, certainly the past 25 years in different contexts, but that all kind of fits together after a while.
Yeah.
Like Gordon Parks, as you,
mm-hmm.
was the black photographer for Time Life magazine. And he was assigned to take photos of the Nation of Islam, and of course they went right into the CIA or the FBI because they wanted to know where they were living and who the people were. But basically, Gordon Parks gets his CIA controller says, "No, there's not enough people here. We need to have X, Y, and Z." So he goes back to Elijah Muhammad, and Elijah Muhammad actually assembles the people that the CIA wants so that Gordon Parks can take the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So. He is the man who is assigned to start blaxploitation, and it's at the time he starts it is when the establishment has had enough of the Black Panthers, which was a Jewish creation. Again, Eldridge Cleaver's book Soul on Ice. Does anybody seriously believe that Eldridge Cleaver wrote that book? I don't think so. Maybe you believe that. Lee Harvey Oswald killed.
It was probably David Horowitz.
It was David Horowitz and the staff at Ramparts.
Yeah,
who Soul on Ice. But anyway, what you're seeing here is this this the CIA will create proxy warriors. just what like what they did in Afghanistan. And then when they get tired of them or they get out of control, which they always do, which is part of the nature of a proxy warrior, they kill them. And that's what this the FBI did with their COINTEL program about the Black Panthers in Chicago. I know a woman who was in the Black Panthers or hanging around with them, and she said the entire community was terrorized by that murder. And as a result, they all Gordon Parks gave them a new way to become a Negro. So you could be the pimp now. You could be Shaft or you could be Superfly. And these were creations I humbly submit of the CIA, basically as a way of redirecting, reorganizing the Black population away from the revolutionary era of the Black Panthers into something more inward searching, sexualized. This woman told me that her boyfriend wanted to try out things on her that he had seen in the movies. So you have this kind of inward change. They didn't have real strong sexual morals to begin with. And then this was like the coup de grace. That certainly was a function of CIA activity.
And of course, the general white population was targeted in a different way as well, because we were given people like Ginsburg and Gloria Steinem, you know, as
sure. You could talk about feminism as as example of Gloria Steinem worked for the CIA. Mm-hmm. They say once you work for the CIA, you never stop working for the CIA. So
radical feminists who dated Henry Kissinger.
would get six-figure book advances on books that no one would ever read.
Yes, that's how they. Yeah, that's how you're rewarded. And yeah, you can. They don't have to succeed. You're given these. Huge publishing contracts, or you never want for employment or anything.
That, by the way, is also the way they paid off Maliki Martin for his work in subverting the Second Vatican Council.
Yes, I guess it was Kaiser who exposed him, I guess, because of his...
Robert Blair Kaiser was the Time Life correspondent at the Vatican Council, and at the end of his life, he wrote a book called Clerical Error, where he finally went public about the story that everybody knew, which is basically how Maliki Martin ran off with his wife, we knew that, and then we found out that Maliki Martin was working for the Jews to subvert the church's teaching on who killed Christ. The AJC and B'nai B'rith were paying him, and the way they paid him was these big book advances. And they promised Bob Kaiser's wife a job at one of these publishing houses, and that was supposed to lure her to run off with Maliki Martin. So it's in his book, Clerical Error.
As opposed, if you criticize this group or cabal, you get faced with what they call dynamic silence, right?
Where
you...
Yes, and I am a number one dynamic silence guy out there. on the other hand, I mean the fatwa that the SPLC put on me was because of the Jewish revolutionary spirit, and now we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of the publication of the Jewish revolutionary spirit. And we're sending out copies every day all over the world. So, and I think we have moved the ball downfield here in terms of what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say.
Well,
not
I think, in the talk, I was listening to you talk about music. I think this was a couple of years ago. You were up in Wisconsin somewhere, and you talk about the most important thing here is consciousness, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, you'll say awareness of these things. So people, and this is what kind of how... how you've probably been one of the most influential writers I've read, is it's given me the grammar of things that, the grammar to back the things that I've felt and suspected for several years, and now I have the information to back it up. I can also say it with confidence and with some degree of eloquence, I hope, and understanding that people understand it about what's going on, what we've been through. And you've said it yourself, is you woke up one day, you found out you're a guinea pig in a vast experiment. You want to understand why, and that's how I feel.
That's right. Well, thank you for saying that. But I mean, that's in a sense, what we're talking about here is the trajectory of figuring things out. And I knew certain things in 1992 when I wrote Dionysus Rising. And I had to write that book in order to be able to write the other books. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a progressive thing, because I did say about, it was clear that I was talking about Schoenberg as a Jew this kind of Jewish vengeance against music, but I hadn't put it together with anything else, you know, until I wrote the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit,
which is their rebellion against Logos,
right? Yeah. And that's and that led me to the book I'm writing now, which is about Logos. Period. Mm-hmm. So I could not have written the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit without using the word Logos. Could not have done it. You know, and now I'm trying to explore the ramifications of that word for global consciousness.
And understanding just our contemporary politics, because there's so many things from abortion to pornography to the imposition of gay marriage and these things, their influence, organized Jewry or Jewish organizations and how they're so influential, why they're so, I guess, so uniform behind these things.
Yes, I think that the rejection of Logos is the answer. And the term Logos refers to exactly what Lorenzo was saying to Jessica. It's an order of the universe. It's the order behind the movement of the stars, but it's also the order behind the movements in your soul, which are manifested or let's put portrayed most effectively by music.
Yes.
Music goes directly, gives a representation of the movement, of movements of your soul.
There's a metaphysics in music. Yeah, there's a metaphysics in music obviously certain notes will strike certain emotions and feelings in these things, and how they're arranged depends on how we feel when we listen to music. Like there's a beginning, middle, and end. It's like in life, right? And it has to have some sort of a harmony and logic to it. If it doesn't, it turns into a disaster, not only for us individually, but also for as a society. So
that's right. And Plato said it, and this is part of the wisdom of the West.
Well, Dr. Jones, I think we covered it. You'd agree?
I think so.
It's always
a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. It's a great book. I know it's 25 years old, but it's worth reading.
Still in print. You can get it from at culturewars.com. Or, well, let's just leave it. You know where you can get it. CultureWars.com. Everybody knows where you can get it. Other than, but CultureWars.com. It's also on Amazon. You know, it's still in print.
Dionysus Rising and also Degenerate Moderns, which predates it. Another great book. Another sort of book where you can track your intellectual development of these things, your research, understanding of these things.
The sequel to Dionysus Rising was Living Machines, which is about architecture.
And that was Gropius. Yeah, I read that book. That's another thing where I'm reading these books and I'm seeing bits and pieces of these other books about the importance of architecture and the insanity of flat roofs. But
yes.
Anyway, listen. Well, thank you, Dr. Jones. That's Dr. E. Michael Jones. He is the editor of Culture Wars magazine. CultureWars.com. You can subscribe to the magazine there and also get his books there. So I'll let you go, and I'll post this very soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.